Hello, and welcome to Words on Film, the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. I'm Dan Burke, your host and movie critic, and you're listening to Words on Film on WBCALP Boston. I will be reviewing some of the newest movies out right now.
And I, of course, am spending a lot of my time in my apartment like many of you people. I'm not saying many of you spend it in my apartment, but in your respective homes. That's just kind of the way of the world right now. And I always wondered, when I've done shows like this before, if I was going to get on the air and say, well, half the population has turned into zombies now, but I never thought I'd say that, and it hasn't gotten that serious yet, but I'm going to change the subject before I sound way too insensitive. But in any event, my point being that, as I've said over the last couple of weeks, going to the movies is not an option, I don't think, for anyone. At first I thought movie theaters were just closed in major cities, but I'm pretty sure they're closed just about everywhere, i.e., the country has not opened up. I'm not really in any hurry for the country to open up. Like many Americans, I'm one of those people who says, yes, I would love the country to open up again and things to get back to normal. But of course, I want to make absolutely sure that that curve they're talking about is flattened. So far, it hasn't been. So I'm just going to stay in my home until that happens. But the good news is, thankfully, with modern technology, and I don't really have to tell you this, but new movies can be brought right to our homes. I do miss the movie theaters because I think at home, for me, there are way too many distractions. I still have my cell phone on. The phone could ring. Of course, you know, I don't have a sufficient number of snacks. There are a lot of reasons. But in any event, I'm doing the best I can in life in general, but especially when it comes to watching movies. And I hope you all are out there staying safe and staying as healthy as possible yourselves. With that said, I have three brand new movies to review for you. The first one is a Netflix original that just came out yesterday. Oh, actually, I'm sorry. It came out, I saw it yesterday, but it actually came out about 2 months ago. The movie is called The Last Thing He Wanted, and this is directed by Dee Reeves, who also wrote the screenplay, based on a book of the same name that was written by, if I can get that name, Joan Didion. The name of the movie and the book is The Last Thing He Wanted. And actually, I am mistaken again. It is a Netflix original. It premiered in the U.S. on February 21st, 2020, but it didn't premiere on Netflix until April 17th. So I was seeing it for the first time yesterday, but so I can't exactly guarantee that it's a brand new movie, but I can guarantee that it is new to Netflix. So what is The Last Thing He Wanted about? It actually is a movie with an all-star cast, including Anne Hathaway, Ben Affleck, Rosie Perez, and Willem Dafoe, and a few other surprising cameos here and there. But it's a movie that takes place in the early 80s during the Reagan administration. And it revolves around a veteran D.C. journalist, i.e. Washington, D.C., who loses the thread of her own narrative when a guilt-propelled errand for her father thrusts her from byline to unwitting subject in the very story she's trying to break. So this is a movie that is full of a lot of espionage and international relations. I have not read the book upon which it was based, but I'd really like to. I do hate that when I go into a brand new movie and then I find out partway through it that it's based on a book, either through the credits, because I am a proponent of reading the book before seeing the movie. But even reading the book before seeing the movie is a little bit of a double-edged sword, because in almost every instance, the book is better than the movie. So the good part is reading is great and more people should be doing it. The bad part is if you read the book beforehand, especially in a movie with a lot of twists and turns like this one, you already know basically what the twists and turns are going to be. Again, it's hit or miss, but basically I came into this with ideally no expectations, which is how I try to approach every movie. And I can already tell from the way this movie was executed that there were various parts missing from the book that would have been crucial to the story. Now, the last thing he wanted clocks in at 1 hour 55 minutes, but I really wish they had developed certain ideas in this film to make it better. For instance, Anne Hathaway is really good in this movie as a no-nonsense reporter by the name of Elena McMahon, who, as we see earlier in the film, is not new to international journalism and being on the front lines in her work. In other words, she is used to going to impoverished, war-torn countries like El Salvador, as we see her in the beginning of the film. But then, eventually, when she reconnects with her father in this movie, who's played by Willem Dafoe, and she finds out that he's tied into international espionage, and she tries to tie the loose ends of his business up, there are things that are revealed about Anne Hathaway's character that would be significant, but the movie doesn't exactly treat it as significant. For instance, you don't find out that Anne Hathaway has an estranged daughter, and by estranged I mean that she's in private school and Anne Hathaway's character doesn't really connect with her all that much until about halfway through the film. And once it happens, the movie treats it like something you probably should have known when you began the film. Also, there is a full frontal scene with Anne Hathaway in it. And before you guys who are listening to this podcast immediately start buying this movie, or rather watching this movie on Netflix for this scene, the reason I bring it up is because you find out from that full frontal scene that Anne Hathaway's character has a breast missing, i.e. where there should be a breast, there's a scar, which leads you to believe that her character has breast cancer. Now, this would be a very intriguing tidbit of information to tie into the film, but it never really does. It's never mentioned before in any of the prior scenes. She's just topless, and then you see she's missing a breast, and you think, okay, she has breast cancer. What exactly does that have to do with the rest of the film? And it really doesn't. And I think that's one of the big problems with this movie. And it has nothing to do with the way either Anne Hathaway or Willem Dafoe act in this film. I think they act really well. And Anne Hathaway is also really good in this movie alongside Rosie Perez, who plays another reporter alongside her who has the same kind of on-the-field experience and is her biggest ally. But unfortunately, there are twists and turns in this film, in addition to the crucial pieces of Anne Hathaway's character that should have been revealed but weren't, that feel random. And when these twists happen, they feel so far out of left field that they probably came from another ballpark. So it's really unfortunate that the last thing he wanted falls short of being a really good spy espionage thriller, especially with a protagonist like Anne Hathaway's character, who is experienced in the field of journalism, but not so much in the field of being a spy or being a member of a cartel, or at least a reluctant member of one. So, and to top this all off, Ben Affleck is in the movie for a total of about 7 minutes, and his character is in the film, I don't think, enough to establish him as even an antagonist or a protagonist, depending on where this movie wants to go, which I won't exactly give away. But the last thing he wanted falls very short of being a thrilling movie. And I was very disappointed by it, especially given the cast. And I was also disappointed because Anne Hathaway is actually really good in this film. The fault is not with her, unlike maybe in a movie like Serenity, for instance. But even though Anne Hathaway was bad in Serenity, there was a lot more about that movie that was bad. It wasn't entirely Anne Hathaway's fault that movie was bad. But fortunately, even though The Last Thing He Wanted wasn't a great film and fell short because of the pieces of the story that the filmmakers probably took for granted that the audience would have to extrapolate, I think that Anne Hathaway was excellent in this film, and I think this shows a positive trajectory beyond a movie that could have been a career-killing one like Serenity. But as it stands, The Last Thing He Wanted gets my rating of a strikeout because it has all the right pieces. It has the good actors. It has the really good on-location shooting, or if it's not on location, it looks very much like it could be on location, but a very confusing story and missing pieces of the story that were undoubtedly included in the book makes this movie fall short. But if you are interested in seeing it for yourself and maybe even proving me wrong, it is available on Netflix right now. The next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is one called The Main Event, which is also a Netflix original. It's not a brand new Netflix film, but I saw it a couple of days ago. It was released on the platform on April 10th, and this is a movie where WWE serves as a major plot point. And in conjunction with Netflix, this movie, The Main Event, was also, probably not surprisingly, brought to you by WWE Studios. And this is definitely not the first movie which WWE Studios has produced and put out there. And it's no surprise that a vast majority of WWE films are about wrestling, and The Main Event is certainly no exception to that rule. WWE Films actually did release one film that was A, not about wrestling, and B, had no wrestlers in it, which was actually kind of strange. The movie was called Sleight, which is spelled S-L-E-I-G-H-T, as in sleight of hand, like a magician. And the movie was actually about a magician. And that one was pretty good, but I think that WWE Films are not wrong to stick to movies that are about wrestling. And this movie, I at least shows that they're on the right track in that regard. So this movie has a very familiar formula. It's a movie about an 11-year-old aspiring wrestler who's played by a very talented young actor by the name of Seth Carr, who, after discovering a magical mask, one of those Macho Libre masks, like the one that Mexican wrestlers wear, he enters a competition to become the next WWE superstar. The movie also co-stars Tashina Arnold from TV shows like The Neighborhood and Everybody Hates Chris as a character that's known as Grandma. And it's a little strange that a woman like Tashina Arnold would play a grandmother now. She is, after all, only 50 years old. But then again, it is conceivable that a 50-year-old would be a grandparent. It happens all the time, although there's a little bit of a backstory to that. And the main character, played by Seth Carr, whose name is Leo, by the way, has a father, whose name is Steve, who's played by Adam Pally. And you find out throughout the film that Leo's parents are divorced, yet he and his father actually live with their grandmother, and the grandmother is the mother of the wife who has left the father and son. That's a very interesting family dynamic of a father who's living with his actually former mother-in-law. I'm not exactly sure how that exactly works, but the movie basically just says go with it. And that's actually probably one of the more interesting parts of it. And I do have to say that Tashina Arnold and Seth Carr made me believe that they were related. They had a remarkable amount of family chemistry in the scenes they were in. And she served as a really good ally. And I've liked Tashina Arnold basically ever since I saw her in the underrated but surprisingly well-syndicated show Everybody Hates Chris. I think she's a very good actress and she's very funny. But the story here is a bit predictable, especially when it involves somebody putting on a magical mask. Of course, I was immediately reminded of the Jim Carrey movie, The Mask. It doesn't rip that movie off, but I think a lot of the things in this movie about the 11-year-old kid who's in, I think, junior high at that point, and is a misfit and is picked on by bullies, and he's obsessed with WWE. He enters a competition where, of course, because of his size, he's the underdog. And the way these sports movies go, that was a little predictable, in addition to some of the other subplots, a few of which were unnecessary, that would go with a movie like this. For instance, his identity isn't kept secret to the people who are closest to him, including his best friends in the movie and one girl who is his love interest, as these movies that take place in junior high generally go. But there is one particularly unnecessary subplot that I hinted at, where he gets into this character, he becomes really popular as he advances through this WWE tryout tournament, and he eventually gets his reputation to his head. This is not only a tired subplot, but it's also not particularly honed in upon in this film. In other words, the movie kind of sticks with it for about 5 minutes. He says some things to his friends that he doesn't mean. His friends eventually turn their back on him. And then there's that music that's borrowed from Full House reruns in the background as he contemplates what he's become. And then eventually he apologizes and the movie kind of moves on. I thought those elements of the plot were both predictable, cliche, and unnecessary, but I did actually really like the wrestling scenes in this movie. And I do think that WWE films could probably be more forgiven for putting elements of WWE in their films and maybe hyping their own events up, because WWE is all about hype. It's a little cliche to say that wrestling is fake. Fake is not the right word for it, but wrestling is, for lack of a better term, rigged. And I think for that reason, as you're going into this film, it's not quite as effective, the idea of these wrestlers duking it out and making the audience, or at least those who aren't familiar with professional wrestling, think that they are actually fighting with all their might, unlike other films about sports. But WWE can be forgiven for the embellishment because they're all about embellishment. Unlike other sports leagues like the NHL, the NBA, the NFL, name a sports league that is, at least as far as we know, a lot more legitimate. And if they made a film that embellished the idea of their own league, that would be a lot more shameless self-promotion, or I should probably say shameful self-promotion, it's shameless on their part, than WWE has in this movie. But I did think, for all its predictable elements, and particularly where the kid Leo is trying to reconnect with his father, who's still living with him, but of course is overworked as these movies go, I thought those were a bit predictable, but the movie itself was actually kind of fun. I enjoyed it, and even though it's not a great film and probably won't make my list of best movies of the year, probably not by a long shot, I did like it, and I do give it my rating of a checkout because I did think that the wrestling scenes in the movie were fun. There were various parts in the movie with the child actor Seth Carr and with his grandmother, played by Tashina Arnold, which did make me laugh out loud quite a few times. And I think that people who are into wrestling and follow WWE a lot closer than I do will also enjoy this film. And also, it is rated TVG, so it's not a movie that's bad for kids either. And I don't think it's ultra-violent as WWE has been accused of being in the past, and I think understandably as well. Next movie I'm going to be reviewing for you is L.A. Originals, which is also a Netflix original film. This is a documentary that premiered on Netflix on April 10th, 2020. And this is a documentary that tells the true story about photographer Esteban Oriol and artist Mr. Cartoon, who turned their Chicano roots into gritty art, impacting street culture, hip-hop, and beyond. And this movie is actually directed by Esteban Oriol, who is not only a photographer, but also a documentary filmmaker, who actually has a very impressive resume when it comes to not only photographing and directing, but he also used to be a DJ for the group House of Pain and Cypress Hill. And that is all covered in this documentary as well. As far as documentaries go, I think hip-hop fans will love it, and particularly people who are very familiar with the other parts of LA besides the more glamorous parts that you only see in the movies. I do think there is a bit of a risk in this film where Esteban Oriol is documenting his own life. And especially when you have people who are interviewed for this film, high profile people like Snoop Dogg, Eminem, and 50 Cent, just singing the praises of both Esteban Oriol and Mr. Cartoon. For that reason, it doesn't exactly qualify as a great documentary because it does seem a bit self-serving. But me being a fan and an appreciator of hip-hop, I did watch this documentary and I enjoyed it. And I especially liked the rags to riches idea of these two guys who were misfits who turned their passion for art and photography into a viable business in East LA. And a lot of East LA is the bad part of LA. I do seem a bit apologetic when I talk about the bad parts of a city, but basically every city has bad parts, and especially among the biggest cities in the world, and most especially in America, they all have bad parts. But I do like the idea of two guys who are from the part of LA that you don't see in the movies, taking something they love and making a business out of it. I can appreciate that. But I am not a tattoo guy. And this guy, Mr. Cartoon, started out as a graffiti artist, and that is well documented in this movie, but he eventually turns his talent to tattoos. And he says, not surprisingly in this movie, that going from doing graffiti art or even doing art on paper to doing art on somebody else's body is a whole other ball game, which is not exactly a profound statement because I couldn't both get a tattoo myself or most especially put tattoos on somebody else. And I don't really understand. I do kind of understand the appeal of tattoos, and tattoos aren't as tacky or as taboo as they used to be, especially among the hip-hop community. But even outside of that, tattoos are becoming a little bit more mainstream, for better or for worse. But what I don't understand is people who cover their body with tattoos, like Ray Bradbury's Illustrated Man. And Ray Bradbury's Illustrated Man was supposed to be an exaggeration of somebody who gets a lot of tattoos. And nowadays, it's a lot more common to see people who have every part of their body, except maybe even their face, but even then, just covered from conceivably head to toe with tattoos. I'm always wondering, why would you want to put something on your body that you can never take off? Or if you do take it off, it would cost more money and would cost a lot more time. And getting off on a little bit of a tangent here, I do remember hearing horror stories, particularly from baby boomers, where they had a boyfriend or a girlfriend with whom they were in love at the time, and they would have a tattoo of them in an area that most people couldn't see, but they'd have to carry that tattoo with them for the rest of their life, especially when the relationship didn't work out. In fact, getting off on another tangent, Tom Arnold, the actor, has a tattoo of Roseanne Barr, his ex-wife, on his chest. And you don't see Tom Arnold with his shirt off nowadays. There's a reason for that. Particularly when, I mean, it's a little bit more forgivable because the two of them were married for a couple of years, but of course, they're not anymore. They haven't been for 25 years, but still, I bet Tom Arnold definitely regrets getting that tattoo. But even if you don't have the face of an ex-girlfriend or an ex-wife, in my case, on any part of your body, and even if it's things like dragons or, you know, things that you might think were cool when you're in your 20s, I don't quite understand why you would want to put that on your body and keep it there for the rest of your life. But either way, the tattoo industry is a viable industry. You have Snoop Dogg in this movie saying, you know, looking at the camera and saying, you have not had a tattoo unless you get it from Mr. Cartoon, which is a ringing endorsement. But the reason this documentary falls short for me and why I don't consider it a great documentary, although I do think it's very entertaining to watch, but the reason it's not great is because it feels like self-promotion. And don't get me wrong, if Snoop Dogg listened to my show and told everyone he knows that if you want to listen to a film review show, listen to Words on Film, I'd be ecstatic. I would love it. I mean, of course, if anybody said that, famous or not, who didn't know me personally, I of course would be flattered. But in the context of this film, it does seem like, especially when you have Esteban Oriol directing this film himself and giving a proverbial shout out to his best friend, Mr. Cartoon, it does feel like self-promotion more than a valid and viable documentary. But with that said, I did enjoy it. I'm not a tattoo guy, but I can appreciate the people who do this for a living and who have a devoted clientele list. And I also like the idea of, as I said before, these two guys who came from seemingly nothing, creating their own niche and creating a viable business that you probably hadn't heard of if you live outside of LA, unless you watch this Netflix documentary. So I do give it a marginal recommendation. It's just not one of the greatest documentaries I've seen. I might as well continue the rest of the show by giving you a preview of movies that are coming out on DVD, Blu-ray, maybe in some rare instances 4K, and or streaming. So there are actually a number of films that are coming out, or actually that have come out this past Tuesday, which is April 14th. And one of the films that came out this past week is Just Mercy. And this is a powerful and thought-provoking true story that follows lawyer Brian Stevenson, who is a real guy, and the movie is played by Michael B. Jordan, and his history-making battle for justice. The movie co-stars Jamie Foxx, Brie Larson, and O'Shea Jackson Jr. O'Shea Jackson Jr. was the actor who played Ice Cube in Straight Outta Compton, and he just so happens to be Ice Cube's son in real life. But even though he probably had a bit more nepotism to get to where he is today as an actor, he actually deserves to be where he is because he is, despite his family connection, an excellent actor. And I would probably even go as far as to say that he is a better actor than his father. Because Ice Cube, even though he is a decent actor, usually plays the same kind of character. He usually plays a tough guy. Of course, he didn't get probably formally trained as an actor the same way O'Shea Jackson Jr. did, but the tough guy roles work for Ice Cube, and he does a decent job at them. Another movie that's coming out on DVD and Blu-ray is one called Underwater. This is a movie that looks a lot like Alien and films like that. It's a movie about a crew of underwater researchers who must scramble to safety after a mysterious earthquake devastates their subterranean laboratory. The movie stars Kristen Stewart, Vincent Cassell, and TJ Miller. And while I haven't seen this movie and I can't recommend it because I don't know how good a movie it is, it having Kristen Stewart in it makes me a little bit reluctant to see it because Kristen Stewart as an actress is a bit hit or miss. I think she has mostly shaken off the stigma of being in the Twilight movies, which of course were massive hits, but didn't particularly give a lot of credibility to the actors in it. But Robert Pattinson, I think at this point, has completely shaken off his stigma in his involvement with the Twilight movies, but I don't particularly think Kristen Stewart has yet. But my problem with Kristen Stewart in a lot of these films is not the fact that she used to be in a movie series that, by all accounts, were bad. And the people who flock to movie theaters to see the Twilight films have graduated from high school and maybe even college at this point and moved on. My problem with Kristen Stewart is she seems to be a good actress only when she wants to be. For instance, she was in a movie called Still Alice with Julianne Moore, and she was in there with a number of other notable actors like Alec Baldwin, and she was great in that film. However, she was also in a few other films which I don't think really showcased her talents as well. And there was one particular one she was in with Jesse Eisenberg, which was called Cafe Society, where she kind of came off, instead of a convincing woman who's living in the 1950s, she came off more like a jaded millennial. And I'm really surprised that Woody Allen, with as much directing experience as he's had, would have let her get away with such a jaded and underwhelming performance. She's also been in a number of movies over the last couple of months. She hasn't really stopped working. She was in a reboot of Charlie's Angels, which I didn't get to see, but it bombed in theaters. She was also in a movie that got mixed reviews, which is called Seberg, which was about the activist Jean Seberg, who was a French New Wave icon who became an activist in the late 1960s, and she was targeted by J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. It sounds like an amazing film. I did not get to see it. It came out in late December of 2019, just in time for Oscar season, and it did not receive any nominations. It actually only received 2 nominations total for from the Alliance of Women Film Journalists, and this is really funny. She was nominated for the award, Kristen Stewart was, Actress Most in Need of a New Agent. I don't exactly know if Kristen Stewart's agent is the big reason why Kristen Stewart isn't doing particularly well in these films, but she's getting lead roles, so her agent must be doing something right. But the other nomination that Seberg received was from an award company called Camera Image. I'm not sure what the story is behind that award ceremony, but Benedict Andrews was nominated for that film for Best Directorial Debut, but Seberg received absolutely no Golden Globe nominations, Oscar nominations, SAG Award nominations. Name the award ceremony, it didn't get nominated. I would be kind of interested to see that film, but as it stands, it definitely hasn't been released on DVD or Blu-ray yet. I think it probably might be available for streaming, but according to my research right now, it doesn't look like it would be. That I reviewed for you for this show are actually the only ones that I've seen this week so far. But now that I have some time and there are no films that are being released in theaters now because movie theaters are closed, and if there are any new films that aren't being delayed until this pandemic gets underway, they are being released on streaming. And actually, I was really hoping to see this week the movie Trolls World Tour, and I actually had the opportunity to see it on streaming, not on Netflix, which is where I see most of my films now, not to mention TV series, but it is on video on demand right now. But from my streaming service, to see Trolls World Tour once would have cost me $19.99. And seeing a movie like Trolls World Tour, I wouldn't want to pay that much for it. I certainly wouldn't pay that much at the movie theaters. And given that it's a movie I don't anticipate that I'm going to love, I definitely wouldn't pay the extra amount of money to even see it in 3D or RPX, IMAX, you name the gimmick of high definition that movies have right now. I would not pay extra money to see that film. If I had the option to go to the movie theaters, I would see a matinee of it. But unfortunately, I don't have that option. So let me get into the movies that are either out right now on Netflix that I haven't seen or movies that are coming out on Netflix, because many of you have Netflix. I don't have other streaming services like Hulu or Disney Plus. It's one of those things that's kind of on my bucket list of streaming services to get, but I only have so much money and so much time in my day. There is a movie that's actually been out on Netflix for quite a while, as of the recording of the show, a week and a half. The movie is called Tiger Tail, and this is a foreign film from Taiwan. It tells a story about Pin Ju, who is leading a vibrant life in Taiwan. He's young and in love and has the whole world ahead of him, but an opportunity in America leads him to a loveless marriage and long years of hard work. To turn things around later in his life, he confronts what he left behind and opens up to his daughter. Tiger Tail is the work of Alan Yang, co-creator of the Netflix original series with Aziz Ansari, which is called Master of None. I haven't seen that series, but I hear great things about it, and it's a retelling of his father's own immigration story. This sounds like an awesome film. I'm not recommending it because I haven't seen it, but I'm telling you that I will seek it out, and I will let you know what I think in one of the future shows. There's another film that came out on April 17th, so more recently, as of the recording of this show. It is a Netflix original, and it's called Sergio. And Sergio is the true story of a dashing and charismatic UN diplomat who has led a rewarding and exciting life. At the end of his career, he's looking forward to finally settling down with the woman he loves, Knives Out star Ana de Armas, who is an excellent actress. She was great in Knives Out and almost nominated for an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress, which I actually think, having seen the movie Knives Out, she deserved it, but she probably will be nominated for something else eventually. But then again, getting back to this, the character Sergio is looking forward to finally settling down with Ana de Armas' character until a bombing in Baghdad, Iraq, leaves him fighting to survive. It's based on a true story, and Netflix actually also has a 2009 documentary of the same name, which is probably still available on Netflix, about the life and true story of Sergio Vieira de Mello. So, a movie that is acted, which is based on a documentary, is a little bit of a tricky act to follow, because really, when you've seen a documentary play out in real life right in front of you, it's much harder for actors to do that justice. But then again, not a lot of people have seen that 2009 documentary about Sergio Vieira de Mello, or de Mello, I should say. I certainly haven't. So I'm very interested in seeing Sergio, and I probably, A, will see it for a future show, and B, will probably see it before I see the documentary upon which it's based. But with actors like Ana de Armas in this film, it should be pretty good, but then again, I can't exactly guarantee that it is going to be a great film. I can never guarantee it will be great. I just see it, and I let you know what I think on the show. Netflix semi-original series that actually is a collaboration with BBC and Netflix, and it's called Nadia's Time to Eat. I'm not sure if this is a film or a series, but I'll just read it anyway and let you know what it is. So, nobody has walked away from the Great British Bake Off more beloved than Nadia Hussein. And according to the tagline here, you're going to love her even more since she has a new show called Nadia's Time to Eat. It is a show. But let me just read the rest of the description. Nadia's Time to Eat pairs her sunny attitude with stress-free recipes, two things we could all use right now. So, as you've heard me say before, Words on Film is a show dedicated to films, not TV shows, but I just gave you a recommendation. Actually, I didn't give you a recommendation. I just gave you a synopsis for a show that's on Netflix that looks to be a reality cooking show. So if you're into that kind of thing, you're welcome. Let's see. Other things that are coming to Netflix this month. I'm going to try to focus on movies that are originals, and the site that I'm looking at is not giving me a lot of details other than movie or TV show names. So I think I'm probably just going to go to another site, unless this site can give me any other recommendations. So let me go into movies that are either coming out on Netflix or might be originals. There's one that came out on April 18th, 2020, that's being released to Netflix for the first time. It is not an original film for Netflix. Although if Netflix put their hands on this film, they probably would have made it better. It's the 2010 critical and commercial flop, The Green Hornet, starring Seth Rogen, Tom Wilkinson, and Cameron Diaz. The Green Hornet is a movie that was in development hell probably since the 90s. But then when Seth Rogen got his hands on it and agreed to both co-write the screenplay and star in it, the movie had a lot of promise. Unfortunately, those promises were broken. I'm mistaken. It wasn't 2010 that the Green Hornet came out. It actually came out in 2011. And it was not the only Green movie that came out that year that was a critical and commercial disappointment and failure. The Green Hornet came out the same year, mere months before The Green Lantern, starring Ryan Reynolds, and both of those movies were based on previous mediums. The Green Hornet was based on an old serial radio show, and The Green Lantern was based on a popular comic book character, and both those films did not do their source material justice. The reason that The Green Hornet sucked so bad was there were a lot of reasons. It was directed by Michel Gondry, and Michel Gondry has directed a number of surreal artistic films that were beautifully directed by him, including but not limited to Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Dave Chappelle Block Party, The Science of Sleep. Those are all films where Michel Gondry was able to take his artistic talents and put them to good use in the film. And The Green Hornet restricted him greatly from doing that. I think he was the wrong director for the movie, but also the screenplay, even though it was written by Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, who also wrote the screenplay to Superbad, which was an excellent film, it just wasn't the right medium for either of those writers. And when you see the film, it definitely shows. But again, if you want to watch it, it is on Netflix. These other things that are listed on this website that I'm looking at look to be TV series rather than movies. But there are other shows that are coming out on Netflix, like Cooked with Cannabis, which sounds like a series, The Midnight Gospel, which may or may not be a series, and also The Vatican Tapes. Well, The Vatican Tapes actually was a film that was released in 2015. It's coming out on Netflix to be streamed on April 20th, which is Monday, as of the date of this recording. And it's the movie about a priest and two Vatican exorcists who must do battle with an ancient satanic force to save the soul of a young woman. The movie stars Olivia Taylor Dudley, Michael Pena, and Doug Ray Scott. I'm very familiar with Michael Pena. I'm not familiar with this movie, even though I saw about 200 films in 2015. I did not actually see The Vatican Tapes, or if I did, I don't remember it, which pretty much tells you what the film is basically like. In other words, it is forgettable. But then again, I can't vouch for it because I have not seen it. This other movie that I mentioned, or rather as a TV series, is one called The Midnight Gospel. It's premiering on April 20th, and that is actually a series. It's an animated series, and it looks very cool, but I can't recommend it because this is a show that is about movies, not about TV shows. Let's just look forward to April 24th, because that's a date where new movies are most likely to be released. So on April 24th, there actually is a brand new Netflix original film called Extraction that's coming out. The movie stars Chris Hemsworth as Tyler Rake, who is a fearless black market mercenary who embarks on the most deadly extraction of his career when he's enlisted to rescue the kidnapped son of an imprisoned international crime lord. So with Chris Hemsworth as the lead, this is promising. The movie also co-stars a very pretty young woman by the name of, and I will pronounce this name as best I can, Golshifteh Farahani. She, of course, is an Iranian actress. And the movie also co-stars David Harbour, as well as other people of Middle Eastern descent, mostly. It looks like a promising film. I can't guarantee that it's good, but I will see it next week, and I will let you know what I think on next week's show. Another Netflix movie that is available for streaming right now, it debuted last year at the Toronto International Film Festival, and it's called The Platform. The Platform actually sounds like an awesome action film. It's about a vertical prison with one cell per level. That makes me feel claustrophobic when I think about it. The platform, the vertical prison, has two people per cell. Again, that'd be great if you had a great roommate, but not if you absolutely hate your cellmate. To make it even more claustrophobic for you, only one food platform and 2 minutes per day are available to feed these prisoners from up to down. And as you might imagine, an endless nightmare is trapped in the hole. So reading that plot synopsis, that makes me instantly claustrophobic, which makes me really, really want to see this movie. I can't exactly tell you when it was released on Netflix. It is a 2019 film, so I can't say it's brand new. And certainly people at film festivals all over the world, most especially at the Toronto Film Festival, which I'd love to go to someday, have seen this film. It was certainly good enough for Netflix. I am very intrigued of seeing this film. But the lead actor in the film is Iván Mazagui, who is Spanish. I believe this is a Spanish film because the actors are from Spain. And we don't see actually a lot of films from Spain that make their way to this part of the Western world, i.e. in North America for viewing in the United States and Canada. Certainly not in a lot of theaters, but films that are released in theaters are irrelevant these days for obvious reasons. So the platform is available for viewing on Netflix. I will check this movie out. Hopefully I don't become claustrophobic from seeing this film. But then again, I'm not somebody who is particularly claustrophobic, but as I tell some of my closest friends, with that being said, if you bury me in a box, I will freak the hell out. I think that's a very rational reaction. That just about does it for this week's edition of Words on Film. Words on Film is the spoken word show dedicated to moving pictures. Even though it's ending, it still will be when I come back next week. And I am your host and movie critic, Dan Burke, reminding you that the views and opinions expressed on Words on Film about movies or other topics are solely those of your host and movie critic, Dan Burke. They do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of any employees or volunteers who are working at the station airing this broadcast, or the station as a whole. There are a lot of great TV series that are available on streaming services like Netflix and Hulu right now. We are in the true golden age of TV shows, but to reemphasize my point, this is Words on Film, not Words on TV. And I have time to watch movies. I don't particularly have time to watch a lot of TV, even with the streaming services out there. But even in spite of that fact, I still have a great time coming on this show and talking to you guys about movies. Whether or not you agree with me, I hope you at least got something out of this too. And until next week, this is Dan Burke saying I'll see you at the movies.